Okay, first I am delighted to welcome Professor Lowenthal, who is Director of the Research Center for Therapeutic Education at Roehampton University. He's going to present his paper, and then we'll have a response from Professor Robert Henshelwood, who's a member of the British Psychoanalytical Society and Professor of Psychoanalysis at the Center for Psychoanalytic Studies at Essex University, and then we'll have time for discussion afterwards. So, to Bill Lowenthal.
Okay. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes,
sir. Okay, good. Thanks ever so much for coming. Ivan's just asked me to say a few things like the loser there and up there, and the air conditioning can go on or off according to whether these windows are open or closed, and things like that. And also it's being recorded, Ivan, is that right?
Yeah.
Yes, everyone, people need to know that. So what's your language? I'm very, very honoured to take part in this conference. In this way, following publication of our book, Post-Existentialism for Psychological Therapists, Towards the Therapy Without Foundations. So thanks for coming, and thanks particularly to our distinguished respondents for taking the time and trouble to come here today. However, now that you're here, and hopefully Ivan's banked your money, I need to come clean at least on two aspects. The first, and I think most important, is that in the programme, it's written, should we have a therapy without foundations, or is it possible or even necessary to create a psychotherapy without foundations? Now, this phrasing might suggest what some term agency. Instead, what's primarily being advocated today, possibly with the help of post-existentialism, is that psychotherapy has no foundations, and that theory, whilst it can be helpful, is not foundational, and that perhaps to consider it as such, dare I say it here, is delusional. What is being put forward today is that psychotherapy is a practice and was initially discovered as such. It is therefore possible for a theory to have implications, but to consider theory as the foundation or as an application, as might more readily be seen in cases of manualisation, is based on a false premise. Well, previously, perhaps those interested in phenomenology came closest to having such a relationship with theory. But phenomenology went out of fashion. More of that later. Actually, I previously started to develop the notion of post-phenomenology. As I mentioned in the book several years ago, I was invited to talk to the American Psychological Association about this. And on leaving the lecture hall, someone still unknown to me tugged at my sleeve and said to me, we'd understand this much better if you called it post-existentialism. Well, I'll see what you think when I leave today. That's assuming I'm not dragged off the podium. I'd first like to tell you about today's overall programme, and in so doing, attempt to come clean about the second aspect I mentioned earlier. Ivan, the Freud Museum, seemed particularly interested in the strapline of our book, which is titled Towards a Therapy Without Foundations. However, and perhaps Carnac will not like me saying this if you've not bought at least one copy already, this is just the title of the last chapter, and apologies to the respondents, but the last chapter is only 4.5 pages in length. Now, this might mean you've been conned yet again, or it might mean we're really going to have a conversation today. I'm at least bolstered yet again by Robert Snell, who remarked to me recently, apparently on another matter, that the last chapter of a book is frequently the start of a book to be written, which hopefully we might be doing today. Well, you will in the papers that follow be reminded of other chapters in the book which I've been involved in with members of our Research Centre for Therapeutic Education at Roehampton, frequently initially coming from their doctoral research. I feel the ideas here reflect our BSc, MSc, PsychD, PhD programmes. And for those of you here who think we are barking up the wrong tree, and perhaps barking mad, you might sympathise with those at Roehampton who so far unsuccessfully have been trying to correct our programmes. out of existence. As I said, in a few moments I will say more about what I mean by towards a practice without foundations, with particular reference to post-existentialism, to which Bob Hinshelwood will be responding. We'll then attempt to start with practice, and Tom Cotton will talk about our research regarding the practice of R.D. Lang and colleagues, with particular reference to Kingsley Hall. Within this section, this will be followed by Rhiannon Thomas, who revisits Binswanger's work with Lodovos in terms of Rhiannon's interest in language and representation, or in this case, perhaps misrepresentation. The respondent for this section is Higher Oakley. The next section focuses more on theory and in particular research. It starts with Julia Kane developing more the notion of post-phenomenology before exploring reverie as a form of research, which she used regarding her interest in the notions of an unknown. She's followed by Dennis Greenwood, who is researching working with someone with a label. He opens up questions of the non-intentional as well as developing the idea of hermeneutic case studies. Well, perhaps allowing thoughts to come to one and checking them out at events such as this one is a more appropriate form of research for psychotherapists. Well, the respondent for that section is Phil Mullen. The final section regarding presentation of papers is to do with the implications for training. The first presenter is John Heaton. He's not directly in the book, though I was previously fortunate in having supervision from John. As you'll see, he continues to influence me, although, as you will find, we don't agree on everything. John will be exploring some implications from Wittgenstein for the training of psychotherapists. Finally, Robert and myself will describe how we think we have gone about attempting to train psychotherapists, to Robert Snell, towards a practice without foundations. The respondent for this section will be Beachy Benvenuto. We hope there's enough time planned for discussion at the end of each of these sections, so we can all take part in a conversation. Well, there are several questions here that we might explore. I think the first one is psychotherapy first and foremost a practice? And secondly, are theories more attempts to explain practice? Or is there really theory foundationally behind our practice, and we just deny it? Do changes in this practice have more to do with changes in our culture that lead us to be more interested in different theories? Or is research, in fact, and just another cultural practice which changes to legitimise the changing dominant culture? Is post-existentialism just attempting to replace one theory with another? Or is it, as my colleague Richard House has kindly said, a reformulation of existentialist ideas within therapeutic practice which prepares the ground for the critical deconstruction of these very same foundations? And what in all this is the place of psychoanalysis? There again, to what extent is our attachment to a particular theory to do with inadequacies in our own foundations? And to what extent does any change, potential for a change, threaten our very foundations? Well, there is that question as to, is what we're presenting today just a process of denial from those psychotherapists who haven't really worked through their relationship with their dads? Yeah? Are all these different psychotherapeutic notions really to keep the psychotherapist occupied, or something else therapeutically useful can happen? A bit magical. Well, with regard to other writers, I just want to mention three. On those last 4.5 pages of the book, I mentioned three other books, which are also questioning the primacy of theory. And I'd like to start off briefly speaking about these, this thought, before saying more about the idea of post-existentialism. One is regarding psychology in general. Steve Brown and Paul Stenner in Psychology Without Foundations conclude that if the discipline of psychology is to grow up, then it must shed some of its methodological weapons and some of its disciplinary armour, and it must climb the specialist walls and breathe fresh air. Is the same true for psychotherapy, including psychoanalysis? There is, of course, the whole question of the terrible state of psychology, particularly in this country, where, for example, in the forthcoming university's research assessment exercise, books are not permitted. It's incredible. Huh? But you can't. Books don't count in psychology. Instead, there's primarily quantitative empirical research in American journals. That appears more to be the norm. Indeed, for some time, relations between people are more for English departments, where there is usually far more chance of studying not only Freud and Lacan, but Derrida, Foucault, etc. Well, another book listed is by John, who's here, John Heaton, in The Talking Cure. Here John argues that psychoanalysis first developed as a practice. Free association in adults and play therapy in children were not theoretically driven, but were found by Sigmund Freud, Melanie Klein, and Anna Freud to be efficient in practice. Such activities were not rationally deduced from a theory of the mind. Freud used his own ideas on language rather than allowing more for the patient's language itself to make clear how it signifies or fails to. John argues that both psychoanalysis and CBT claim to be scientific and rational. They assume that the therapist is rational and can claim the authority to decide what is to be considered valid reality and then correct the patient by some technical means. For both CBT and psychoanalysis, authority in terms of a scientific theory lies outside of practice. Yet once we have scientific representation, the user is necessarily outside the representation. As I think most people here will know from experience, when you're in it, it's different. Authority, therefore, lies in the actual practice of therapy, with its judgment and timing, rather than its ability to construct and apply psychological theories to cure people. John pops the case for the talking cure as a practice in which language in the widest sense may be used to enable the person to find their way to being clearer. I'm sure John will say much more about this shortly. The third book mentioned in the last half page is Fry and Orange's Beyond Postmodernism. It appeared that the so-called relational school of psychoanalysis was seen to have some similarities with post-existentialism when Donna Orange quotes, "We are all, like it or not, postmodern existentialists, searching for connections and meanings, trying to find our way." Orange, interestingly, further suggests that the critique of the Western world of reason can be seen as taking two paths, both to do with Heidegger. One through late Heidegger towards French deconstruction, and another through the hermeneutics of early Heidegger into the work of Gadamer. Gadamer's hermeneutics can be seen as the context, embedded historically conscious and dialogic understanding of human nature. Hermeneutics have also provided a way to distinguish psychoanalysis from the natural sciences and to claim for it its own kind of validity. For Gadamer, a genuine conversation is never the one we want it to conduct. We fall into conversation. For Gadamer, the hermeneutic dialogue always brings into play the background of prejudice and the tradition that all participants bring to the conversation. Prejudices are biases of our openness to the world. We are always embedded in history, in temporality and relatedness. Gadamer and Habermas see the hermeneutic dialogue as a form of practice that is indispensable to being human, which through Aristotle's notions of practice wisdom is not a set of rules, but an art of living wisely with others. Perhaps most importantly, Gadamer argues against a reliance on method in favour of a dialogue as the way to understanding. So there isn't a method to truth. Interestingly, Orange suggests a particular distinction between Gadamer and Derrida, which might be seen as contributing to a distinction between some notions of humanism and psychoanalysis. Gadamer argues that the precondition for dialogue is the trust in the goodwill of the other, whereas Derrida suggests that not only that this goodwill should never be trusted, but even that we will be blinded by our desire to trust the other. Well, in an interesting footnote, Orange suggests that this attitude possibly represents the hermeneutics of suspicion that Paul Ricoeur attributed to Marx, Nietzsche and Freud. Here we have a method of interpretation which assumes that the literal or surface level meaning of a text is a method to conceal the political interests which are served by the texts. So the purpose of interpretation is to strip off the concealment, unmasking those interests. Well, is it possible, though, to have both dialogue and interpretation? Orange further suggests that postmodernism can be seen within those involved in the tradition of scepticism, who have, over the centuries, protested against exaggerated claims to knowledge, unmasked dogmaticism, and relativist totalising worldviews. The resulting scepticism has ranged from a refusal to make any truth claims to holding theory lightly and suspending judgment. Perhaps following more closely Aristotle's injunction to seek in every domain the head of knowledge and degree of certainty appropriate to it. However, with all these what all these authors do have in common is they abhor the reductionist assumptions of enlightenment, claims to objective knowledge present in both past and present forms of psychoanalysis. Orange does, however, appear to acknowledge that the deconstructive tools developed to what is seen as combating Freudian and Kleinian essentialism could themselves result in new reductionisms. So is it animal farm? Orange concludes that a middle ground is possible for psychoanalysis, drawing on undervalued traditions of dialogue and ethical phenomenology. She calls for a moderated postmodernism, focusing on lived experience, suspending our interest in categories and in the facts studied by the natural sciences, viewing relatedness as our primary human situation. Well, interestingly, in the last half page of their book, she mentions Levinas and ethical relations. However, the middle ground for relational psychoanalysis may be different to what we are terming here post-existentialism. Well, I'd now like to briefly consider psychotherapy as a cultural practice. As I've said, to ask, can we have a psychotherapy without foundations, could be read as if we have a choice. What many of us will be presenting today is that there is no actual choice. Psychotherapy does perhaps not have foundations, and that the theories that Freud and others constructed to explain what they found in practice, whilst of considerable interest, cannot be theoretical foundations. The practice was there first. We're involved with such aspects as talk, ritual, gesture, yet one does not do it based on theory. It's a practice, a cultural practice, which can change within a culture and between them. If one theorises about practice, it is done outside of practice. It is different. One might end up theorising about the bone, muscle properties of the hand and arm, or even the mouth as one speaks and gestures, but it won't help much. Isn't the same with psychological therapies? Are they practices which Freud and others later tried to theorise about? But doesn't this theory come from somewhere other than the practice that precedes it? And is it a different kind of knowledge? Also, isn't most of psychology unhelpful here? You know, learning about the ear or the larynx or something, whatever it is, it doesn't help us as a psychotherapist. Are psychotherapy theories any better? However, does Bion come closest to theorising practice with his sister Mo, the realm of the unknown, which psychoanalysts must get access to if they're trained to remember, to desire, perhaps that they have no memory or desire? Or is Pogliani better with his notion of tacit knowledge? There again, to what extent is well-being or the good to do with the knowledge derived from, for example, research? How we are with patients might be seen as an act of judgment. We might reflect on what we have said, but does that make us practitioner researchers? Not if we take research to mean achieving generalisation through some systematic approach. Yet more recently, even theory is not regarded as an important aspect of research. In my experience, if one asks about definitions, I'm on a National Research Psychotherapy Research Committee, one gets labelled as a philosopher and therefore can be ignored. I relatively recently asked at an Economic and Social Research Council meeting how they defined well-being, and the researchers said they no longer bothered, but they thought they knew how to measure it. Well, as John says, it seems that the patients come to us because the explanations they have for their difficulties does not seem to help. There is then the question as to when the explanations we think are unhelpful. There are different ways of attempting to work, some which maybe more easily allow something else sometimes to usefully happen. Psychoanalysis uses an approach which attempts to explore beneath the usual explanations. CBT attempts to change the way we think. I'm favouring what I've termed post-existentialism as with what we might call its method post-phenomenology as coming closer to a therapy without foundations. Well, what about research? Isn't research a cultural practice? So psychotherapy as a cultural practice has or attempts to obtain legitimacy through whatever provides it for that culture. Often these days, research is the legitimising tool, and this more recently has to be evidence-based. Is research rather like therapy in that something happens that can be useful for the researcher, but we don't know really what it is? Is research another cultural practice which, when the fashion changes, we hope that our modalities will come out all right? As one person who took part in a significant RCT said, when I asked her, what's your research got to do with truth and justice? She said, not much with truth, but a lot to do with justice, as it shows my modality works. We then, of course, get researcher allegiance to boot. Research is what all our professional bodies seem to be pushing us to do. Yet isn't this another cultural practice that is linked to legitimising changes in our culture? I've never understood how anyone, and apologies to people here, but with a basic knowledge of science, could ever claim that RCTs could be the gold standard for so much of psychotherapeutic research. Well, this seems to be now more acknowledged by, for example, the head of NICE, and there's now almost a desperate attempt to find another method whereby our modalities can be objectively evaluated, whilst RCTs still continue as the order of the day. What research is really of use to us as practitioners? No? Is there any? From what I can see, very little, if we think in terms of generalisation. Indeed, for those of us interested in research, it seems that one of the most important aspects of our work is to remind people how the consequences of applying any so-called findings to our practices may be more detrimental than beneficial. Well, isn't physis or physis what comes out of itself? But now the measuring instrument determines the therapy, and there's a Vygotsky that states, we're all shaped by the tools and instruments we come to use. There again, in some ways, there seems to be some similarities between doing research and psychotherapy. Both seem to have potential benefits, though it's not clear how this comes about. Students do seem to be able to be more thoughtful, but with regard to research, this has, I think, little to do with the research method, often attempting, for example, to make phenomenology into some psychological research method. Perhaps something happens in both carrying out research and being in psychotherapy that we can never directly understand. Indeed, as Merleau-Ponty has said, sometimes if one attempts to take away the mystery, one can take away the thing itself. Or to put it another way, as happened relatively recently, when a French Minister of Health was under pressure to evaluate psychoanalysis and replied, translation from Robert, psychoanalysis is something else and we should let it be. Well, at last, the question of what the idea of post-existentialism. Well, this idea is an attempt to offer a space where we might still be able to think about how alienated we are through valuing existential notions such as experience and meaning, whilst questioning other aspects such as existentialism's inferred narcissism and the place it has come to take up with regard to such aspects as psychoanalysis and the political. The post-existential would also include the post-phenomenological, where, for example, Merleau-Ponty's notion of being open to what emerges in and between, as well as his notion of embodiment, would be given primacy over Husserlian notions of intentionality. As a result, questions such as those of mystery and unknown and an unconscious and the non-intentional can be re-examined. A third element to be explored today will be the extent to which we might consider more recent ideas, for example, those of Saussure, Levinas, Derrida, Foucault, Lacan, Wittgenstein, without getting too caught up in them. It is hoped that by having a possible space to explore some would now call our well-being, that this can provide a loose space, without concerns of any further generalisation, for a greater possibility of accepting rather than escaping who we are. Well, why post-existentialism? The name is tentatively being put forward in an attempt to describe a potential cultural moment whereby the psychological therapist can be considered to at least start with practice. To give such a name, albeit to a particularly loose mixture of cultural influences, is done with much trepidation. It is not meant to name yet another school. However, such branding is with some reluctance presented as it is considered necessary to counter the hegemony of trained technicians as psychological therapists, perhaps to oil the wheels of our increasingly dominant managerialist culture. The papers in this conference express one way of starting with practice and then consider the implication rather than the applications of theory. Well, whilst at least starting with practice and hopefully continually attempting to return to it is associated with ordinary language, both this and how we consider it is already mediated by the language of our contemporary culture. In working therapeutically, the psychological therapists may find that certain ideas, theories come to mind when working with a client, patient. This is regarded as very different to starting with such theories as a frame-up. Post-existentialism is therefore an attempt for us to experience our alienation in the hope that we may still be able, individually and collectively, to do a little more about it. Further, it's an attempt to consider a potential cultural practice that, in contrast to what our theory-driven therapies consider psychological therapy as essentially subversive. Personally, in not excluding thoughts, and politically, in terms of our relationship with others. Post-postmodernism would be another term that could have been used. Postmodernism is considered to have made important contributions in opening up possibilities for the psychological therapist. Yet to stay with it might mean we'd be unable to communicate with anyone. Post-existentialism is therefore, in some ways, a return to Heidegger's questions of being in the world with others, exploring meanings in their specific contexts without ignoring the work of the postmodernists, the psychoanalysts, or the political. Well, with regard to what is post-existentialism, the post-existential takes, as I say, an important influence from Heidegger's Dasein in exploring the well in terms of being in the world with others. This has been said is a particular mixture of existentialism, phenomenology, psychoanalysis, postmodernism. Post-existentialist taken to mean after Heidegger and in a different way after Husserl, yet looking to retain what might be considered good from both existentialism together with aspects of subsequent developments such as postmodernism. At the very least, we might consider, as David Cooper suggests, that existentialism is worth revisiting at intervals for the help it may offer with themes of contemporary interest. Well, whilst Wilhelm Wundt was one of those who persuaded Husserl away from his more quantitative interests to develop Brentano's descriptive psychology, whose audience, of course, included not only Husserl but a one Sigmund Freud, Wundt considered psychology to be partly a natural science and partly a social science. This fundamental definition of psychology, merging the political with the cultural historical, is lost on most of psychology today, with, I think, devastating consequences. Heidegger did work with Medard Boss, who some felt therefore had the nearest possibility of looking at the implications of Heidegger's writing for existential practice. Interestingly, the so-called British school of existentialism adopted more of Boss's work, but attempted to drop Boss's interest in and strong influence from psychoanalysis. Now this is again in contrast to those such as Aske and Facquart, who state that psychoanalysis, who start with psychoanalysis, and then consider the existential phenomenological. Neither, nor third wave CBT, are what we think we're terming here by post-existentialism. There again, the relational school, whilst questioning meta-narratives and the modern need for objectivity, empiricism and reductionist attempts, do try and show this can all be done within psychoanalysis, albeit with that, whatever that relational take is. Well, it was important, I think, very important when Foucault, who was abandoned his early interest in phenomenology. But was this because he took Husserl's notion, he took as phenomenology Husserl's notion of transcendental phenomenology, which does not really allow for the historical and cultural? Heidegger, with his Dasein as being in the historical cultural world with others, enables phenomenology to be released from Husserl's attempt to show a pure subjectivity. This opening up of phenomenology was further developed for Psychotherapy by Binswanger, Boss, Lang and others, and we're terming the development of this post-phenomenology. Thus, if we could both be attentive to what emerges in the between of client and therapist, and be aware of what is regarded culturally and historically as common sense, we could have an interest in how both our clients and those around them have brought and bring pressures on each other. This meeting, which could include the implications for the present of the client's history and the history of the culture, without being caught up in a potentially totalising approach, would be an example of post-phenomenology, and might also be closer to some aspects of what those such as Wilhelm Wundt saw as psychology. Another consideration is whether starting with notions of existence leads to considering the human soul and the historical and cultural aspects of social rather than natural science. With this emerges the possibility of a political viewpoint that could engage with various notions of, for example, democracy and the idea of an unconscious, also coming from those such as Kierkegaard and Nietzsche. Such possibilities open up returning psychology to its philosophical roots, and with it important implications for those practices aimed at promoting well-being, including, of course, the way we train our students. Well, finally, towards a therapy without foundations. In this introduction, I've attempted to argue for the place of practice at the heart of psychotherapy. This aim could be seen as stretching from the time of Peronian scepticism to more recently the writings of Wittgenstein, where post-existentialism can be understood to be more about the activities in which we participate with our patients. There is therefore an increasing body of opinion showing the futility of theory as the basis of the psychological therapies, and with it, what is currently regarded as research. But the psychological therapies are also cultural practices and are attempting to reformulate an understanding of meaning as contextual and emerging through the meeting of psychological therapist and patient. Thus, how we understand such emerging meaning will be mediated by our cultural practices through the mixture of ideas that permeate our society in any period. This conference is therefore an attempt to put the case for what is termed post-existentialism by defining a particular potential cultural moment, in contrast particularly to the positivistic, managerialist, audit culture that currently pervades. The hope is that the implications of examining meaning through post-existentialism show how such enterprises never have a foundation. Thus, not only CBT, but any therapies, whether they be humanistic, existential, psychoanalytic, which become totalising moves, are potentially violent. At best, such theories are secondary, and whilst they may have implications, the case being put forward today is that they can never provide a foundation to the primacy of practice. Well, I'm looking forward now to hearing both my colleagues developing this, and in particular the thoughts that then emerge from our respondents and everyone here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Del, for setting out the themes of the day so clearly and splendidly, and call upon Bob Henshelwood to respond.
Can you all hear me?
Yes.
I don't know which do I want to use.
It's probably easier.
And this is
that's
on.
It. Yeah.
Can you hear me better or worse now? Good. So we have to be grateful to some extent for science and technology. Yes. I foolishly said I'd respond, but and the first thing I thought when I looked at this book and read his text was that Well, I agree with all that, mostly. And that's not much of a response, is it? Because you want debate, you want sparks to fly, don't you? And I'm not sure I can achieve that for you. I'm not well qualified to respond, because I don't know much about continental philosophy, which is whether Dell lacks foundations or not. It does seem as though continental philosophy is a thoroughly worked out foundation for an approach to psychotherapy and to research. I'm also one of those dyed-in-the-wool psychoanalysts who, at least in places in his text, gets set up as the baddie to knock down. And I have some sort of sensitivity to that. I think that the place of psychoanalysis in the themes that Dell has been talking about is a particular place into which he fits psychoanalysis as an example of a form of therapy overwhelmed by its own theoretical foundations. And I have a bit of nervousness about that. And I might just say one or two words about psychoanalysis as having this role of opponent, a sort of straw man, is it to tackle in order to clarify the position of your position as something which is separate from, a little bit separate from psychoanalysis. Although I do understand that you are looking to psychoanalysis in something of an inspirational way. And indeed you commend psychoanalysis through John Heaton's book as an approach to therapy which started in practice, as if theory wasn't there at the beginning. And I would say this is absolutely wrong. And in some ways agree with you that theory has been a blight of psychoanalysis through the course of its history. And to my mind, even though John Heaton and you may not agree with me, psychoanalysis started in the late 19th century theories of associationist psychology. The whole thing was about the associations, free associations. In the original case of Anna O, she was encouraged to produce her associations under hypnosis. Josef Breuer developed a particular technique for encouraging the display of psychological associations. It's absolutely rooted in 19th century associationist psychology, as I understand it. And the view then on based on associationist psychology that mental abnormality is when you get improper associations or some sort of difficulty in the associative process, which is the basis of the mind. So you get dissociation, and the whole notion of defense and repression of the unconscious, of the disconnection of unconscious with conscious, it seems to me a deeply impregnated by the ideas of associationist psychology, which goes way back, doesn't it, to 17th, 18th century philosophical notions of the nature of mind. John Locke particularly I understand, though I'm not a philosopher. So I am interested in this, the debate here, really. I am quite interested in the debate about the relationship of therapy to practice. You have a particular position on this, and I think it might be a trifle exaggerated. A lot of what you say seems to be predicated based on the idea that therapy either grounds itself in practice or it grounds itself in theory. There seems to be a kind of either or implication about what you are saying. And yet at times you seem to be saying not quite that. So I would say, a position I would feel more comfortable with is that there's a constant reverberation between, a bouncing back and forth between the observations in practice and the theoretical foundations which give some shape or formal account to those observations. I have, being old-fashioned and my intellectual formation was before the collapse of Marxism, I still have a respect for the notion of dialectics and the sense that things which seem to be different and at opposite ends of the spectrum do actually owe a lot to each other in the old-fashioned terms as an interpenetration of one with the other. And I think this applies to the antithesis, the antithetical views of theory and practice, that nobody goes into a practice with a clear mind without an outrageous and alarming number of preconceptions which are both personal and conceptual, intellectual. Nobody develops their theoretical preconceptions without being assaulted from birth with making observations on what the world is like. So I suppose I'm saying, and I'm not sure you are absolutely opposed to it, that there's something like an interesting interaction between practice and theory. This led me to think in my rather unqualified way, as I say, that I can... My response can be, as somebody from outside, as it were, which may not be useless, but it does present me in a sort of slightly alienated position in, on the margins. And the thought that I had developing from this dimension of theory and practice and how one might look at such a dimension, that there are a number of other dimensions which sort of form a grid in which Dell's position and his argument exist. And I thought there might be three other particular dimensions that appear in looking a little bit from the margins and from outside, and that it might be helpful to characterize these dimensions as something which could help discussion during the day. So the first dimension is, what do we make of theory versus practice? Is it an alternative, this or that, or is there some mediated process going on between theory and practice? Another central aspect of what Dell's talking about was the imposition, almost, of theory, the way in which scientific notions of evidence, causality, impose themselves on a more authentic interaction between two beings, two human minds. And I think this resonated an awful lot with me, and gave rise to my saying I agree with most of this, because I remember as a very young psychiatrist not really discovering what my role as a psychiatrist was, and a particular incident with a very paranoid gentleman, and having to assist the nurses to encourage him into the ECT room where his mind would be zapped with electricity in a way which was very common in those days. This was sometime in the mid-1960s. And how uncomfortable I felt in pushing somebody, a paranoid man who rather against his will, it was rather against his will to be assaulted by treatment in that way, and yet identifying myself in the role of a psychiatrist, which I was supposed to be, in all my junior status, trying to perform the role as if I were competent and experienced. It was it's a very uncomfortable memory which has lasted all down through my careers and pushed me into psychoanalysis as a form of understanding as opposed to a form of doing something to people. It led, I don't know, this is my self-advice, it led after 30 years or so to a book on personal autonomy called Therapy or Coercion, which I think is somewhere in the area that Dell wants to get us to think about today. So I was struck by this kind of top-down approach to treatment, which I was learning as a junior psychiatrist. My discomfort in that and my wish to explore something which might be a much more bottom-up process, something which can be grounded in authentic being between people, which could then generate a useful form of understanding as treatment. It took me into therapeutic communities, which is at the time was a rather radical movement. It isn't anymore, but in those days it was a radical movement based on communalism, democratization, and permissiveness. Three slogans. And I think this might be an important dimension, a top-down, bottom-up dimension, which in which therapy seems to be uncomfortably balanced. Another dimension, I'm going to be a bit quick because otherwise I'll take up all the time for discussion, is that the emphasis in Dell's presentation seems to be this imposition of cultural factors, the expectation that therapy will therapize, treatment will treat, and that there is a strong emphasis on the external factors which impose themselves on the encounter between the therapist and his patient. And I'm interested in, well, really most of my career I've been interested in how can those social forces be somehow seen as operating in some integrated or unintegrated way with what I think are the genuinely existing internal forces within the makeup of the human being and derived ultimately from biology, from the body we have and the brain which is the bodily structure which itself must somehow structure the way the mind develops and works. It's always been an uncomfortable problem which I don't think I've really ever found the solution to. Is how do these external cultural factors meet the internal personal experiential factors that come from within the human mind as it has evolved biologically and bodily. So that is the a second dimension, and the third one, just very quickly, was hinted at the end of the presentation, this managerial audit culture, which we encounter as a particular kind of culture, which before when I met Del in the reception there, we swapped notes on how awful it gets in the health service and in the universities, the way in which a kind of formulaic managerialism has to try and encounter the intuitionalism, if that's the right word, of both, I think, both of medicine and of psychology and psychotherapy, that the reduction of human beings to mechanisms about which we can find evidence seems to be at one end of a dimension which stretches right across to a humanistic authentic something which is much more intuitive about human beings. Again, with all these dimensions which I've four dimensions I've mentioned, I think we can take a position that we should be at one end or we should be at the other, or we can take a position that somehow our job is to mediate the extremes of these two positions, even though it may be very difficult. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Bob, for opening up the space for our thinking and discussion there. So well. We now have time for discussion amongst ourselves, and I think we have a roving microphone, so please raise your hand if you'd like to contribute.
This is an initial primary reaction.
It has to go right into the mic.
Sorry, is that better?
Okay.
Sorry, initial primary immediate reaction on the scene of the. Am I not doing anything?
Hold on.
I'm hopeless with anything.
Is that one?
When people speak into these microphones, it seems to work best if you speak directly into them like this.
Have a go now.
Yes. And also, you may like to give your names.
Sorry, my name's Audrey Cantley. I'm an anthropologist. So I know nothing about nothing that can be discussed. But as a primary response to what you call the primacy of practice, I would point out that we're all sitting here on chairs, or on a tabletop with a cloth on it, and which there are a chairman who makes the suitable remarks for a chairman and two speakers in dialogue. Now, this is a format for meetings of this kind. What's said is quite another matter. But it's considered that through this actual physical format, we arrive in some way at truth. It's just wonderful. And the same way, if you look at a book, the way books are written, with what's on the spine, what's on the first page, primacy on the first page, chapters, it's a well-tried method. And it's useful because it survived. But there's no necessity that a published book should actually follow that format. And I think, isn't there something about Derrida's, I think, which attempts, attempts a different format. And so,
just to say, as an anthropologist, would you say the way we're sitting here is based on a theory or a cultural practice?
I would say it was a cultural practice, but on the theory point of view, last time I was in India,
Charles Hampton from Oxford, thank you very much indeed for your presentation. Just an observation, really. I'm getting used at the moment to the new role of training therapist, having students from the training courses in Oxford come to me for therapy. And at various points in my presentation, I've had a sort of yes moment where I've been aware that you're speaking to a phenomenon that I and the patient are working with, in which there is there are three chairs in my room, and we're occupying two of them. The third chair seems to be occupied by a very frowning, punitive, superego presence from the chain that the students are on, which is asking, are we doing it properly?
Yeah.
And has this anything to do with the student's psychological needs? Has this question, are we doing it properly, actually got anything to do with the student's needs as a person?
Nobody immediately has anything. Whether Dale would like to respond to that.
Well, thank you for your question. It's really, a response to what you were saying, Bob, in a way, which thank you very much for your response. My concern is that what's happening is what you're saying is what's happening in people's trainings, how the trainings start, what they give a primacy to, and indeed what people have to give as clinicals and how they give the clinicals. From what I experience of that, it doesn't fit in with what you're saying. I think we do seem to be a particular theory-driven, both in the way that people are learn to be psychotherapists, psychoanalysts, and in the way that they have to give often and talk about their work in order to pass. It seems to me quite odds with the kind of position you were taking. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
I probably shouldn't. I think there are all sorts of versions of psychoanalytic psychotherapy and versions of what the training is like, and I think psychoanalysis has been guilty in the past of providing a very solid platform of theory. It has a special name for it. It calls it meta-psychology, to give it a sort of presence which people will be in awe of. But I think there are strands of psychoanalysis which go very in a very different direction, and I think there will be a paper later today on reverie and some of Bion's work on abandoning memory and desire that is absolutely in a different direction and is very much along the lines that if you go into the session full of wish to use your theory and cure your patient, you're going to be 100 miles away from where the patient is. And there is an interesting paper, I won't go into it because I don't want to take the floor all the time, but there's a very interesting paper by Ron Britton and John Steiner on the difference between the selected fact, which is the emerging idea. This is a term originating with Poincaré, a scientist actually, who wrote a lot about the psychology of mathematics and the way scientific ideas come. On the one hand, an intuitive process, and on the other, the overvalued idea, which is that somebody goes into the session with the idea of the Oedipus complex and knows he's going to find it, or the idea of a depressive position and he knows he's going to find it. So I think there's a strong awareness within psychoanalysis today of these kinds of problems and obstacles and pitfalls.
Great talk, thanks very much. John, I've done the psychologist, so a slightly different angle on these things. And continental philosophy. Just want to say one quick thing about Mikhail Bakhtin, who a lot of you will know through literary theory and the like. A lot of what you say reminds me of The Simpsons. You might remember the episode when Bart and Lisa are talking about various things. And Bart says, for example, Lisa, I'm a doer, not a thinker. And Lisa says, so you're going to act without considering the consequences. You have to have both, really, the doing and the thinking, I think. And Bakhtin, what he does is he eschews any idea of, for example, theory, and he says that it's really dialogical. I think the problem, so to speak, with psychotherapy over the years has been, number one, a feeling of loyalty to Freud or Anna Freud or whoever it may be, that we have to maintain the link theoretically all the way back, and a renunciation of the sense of dialogicality, a toggling between the sense of that we're fair enough, we're moving theory forward, we have ideas, what we do, as this lady at the front suggested, that we, you know, publish in various journals, we sit behind tables, and a sense that we have to respond to the moment, as Professor Hinshelwood did in relation to the paranoid man. His relation to Professor Hampton behind me said that he does in relation to his students. I think there has to be a sense of both, but the question is how you do it. And the reflexivity, I think, is key. I mean, probably about 50 years ago, if we were here, the room would be full of men. I think that's the way psychoanalysis was. So I think that as long as the discipline is one which is reflexive, that is dialogical, that moves forward, it strikes me that a lot of the questions which are posed up there, a lot of them are answered by Hegel, which I don't think was mentioned, and Bakhtin as well. Thank you.
I've really enjoyed that. That's fantastic. Just to mention how psychotherapy sits, or just to remind how therapy sits so brilliantly between science and art, and we tend to forget the art of psychotherapy, and we, I think, most of us may forget to think of ourselves as artists, and it's probably quite a useful, it may be quite useful just to remember.
I don't know if you can hear me. The label of post-date suspension, if I go back to postmodern thoughts, there's something, certainly from Derrida, about putting oneself into question. So when you're with another person, that engagement actually puts the individual into question. If I look at the label post-existential, in what way does that label, what is post-existential putting into question? I noticed that you were talking about intentionality. In what way is intentionality being questioned from a post-existential perspective, I wonder?
So
Eric, I'm sure you've got some thoughts on that. Yeah?
Sorry?
I'm sure you've got some thoughts on that.
It's very problematic because if we as individuals are put into question, our intentionality is put into question. And there's an element of our intentionality is tantamount to being scrubbed out. So it's actually the therapist that then is in need of therapy and not the client. It's almost like that biblical engagement with the burning tree. You know, are you seeing God? Are you seeing the tree? And is one a quality of madness and the other one a quality of inspiration? so I'm always very confused by these things, personally. I suppose that's where I am. So I don't know whether that's a thought or a reverie.
Well, thanks for sharing your dreams with us. I actually think Dennis is probably more able to answer this when he speaks about the non-intentional later today, so I'm going to cop out of it right now. I think there's a kind of whole question about where theory comes in, where it helps and hinders thoughtful practice. You know, theory doesn't necessarily mean thoughtful practice. I think there's issues like that with regard to the previous speaker, but I think there's also just more fundamental questions in what we're looking at. And again, I'm kind of pushing Bob here a bit with regard to what's the place, if any, of the idea of diagnosis? Mm. Yeah? What we're talking about. Is there a place for diagnosis? This kind of strange medical notions of diagnosis and treatment? It seems nuts.
It's useful as far as it goes, and then beyond there, it's a hindrance. You know, I think making a diagnosis of schizophrenia and giving psychotropic drugs has had provided enormous relief of suffering for huge numbers of people across the world. It's not, you know, the side effect is that they're sort of demoted from being people. Which, you know, how much do you weigh it this way or that way? You can say, I'll throw out diagnosis. And you could. But in the process, it may be that you disadvantage huge numbers of people from the possibility of a medical diagnosis, treatment possibility. There's quite a lot in your book about the medical model as if it's another of those baddies who now Hollywood.
Definitely with regard to this.
So, I think DSM and
but in psychoanalysis, just the idea of diagnosis and treatment, do you think it's not has a similarity with how you just described people having electrical treatment?
Yes, I do. And I think to categorise people stops them being people, or it has that effect. On the other hand, you know, people need relief from suffering, mm-hmm. and we don't have perfect treatments. Even psychoanalysis is not a perfect treatment. It can actually do very little, and is wholly dependent on the willingness of the patient. We're not in a perfect world, and we have to measure in the balance. Advantages and disadvantages. You say something, Phil.
Well, this is a very energised discussion, and it is evident that we have all greatly enjoyed this morning so far. So thank you very much. And we have